Well, hello, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I think it's almost 4 o'clock here. We have a few people trickle in, but we'll go ahead and get started. So my name is Jenny, and I'm going to talk to you guys today about some of our history with predators and how, especially with the wolf, that story has culminated in sort of an interesting way. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, and we'll kind of be building on some various canine themes for some of the rest of the week. Normally what I do at Colorado State University is I teach animal behavior, and I teach behavior of domestic cats and dogs, and how veterinarians and vet techs can best interact with them to minimize their stress, help with their handling, and learning about different behavioral problems that they may have. My PhD is in zoology, however, and so I teach an undergraduate course in canine biology, where we touch on a lot of the canine relatives, the process of domestication, which I'll be talking about tomorrow, and then kind of going on into more of domestic dog type things. I'm here with my family, so we have 4 children with us. You probably have seen me running around after one or two or more of them, and you'll probably see that if you haven't. So, well, we're here having a great time, and so today I'm just really thrilled with you to share with you this story. So, as with all stories, we have to start at the beginning, and in this story, we have a very precipitous beginning. It's a hard start with our relationship with the predators that we started as we came out west. The middle has some sad parts, and the end has some happy and still some precarious possibilities. So it's a good story. First, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about the characteristics of the North American wolf. They can be very large. They range between 80 and 120 pounds, depending on where in the country they are. They are canines, so they're related to coyotes. They are very closely related to our domestic dogs. And they have a keen sense of smell. Their best way of moving is trotting. They can effortlessly trot for miles and miles, and part of the story involves that. They tend to eat larger game than, say, a coyote or a fox might. So coyotes are kind of the middle of the canine group in that they eat big things and they eat small things, and they can either do either or. With wolves, they can be more, at least in our Midwest area, our middle of the country type area, they tend to be group hunters, and they tend to bring down larger prey. We'll talk a little bit more about that. As far as their social dynamic, we've heard a lot about the alpha wolf and the alpha structure in both of our pet animals and for wolves. David Meach is one of the foremost biologists who started studying wolves in the 70s, and he is the one who started using the term alpha. And he now has kind of come out and said, you know, it's really not an appropriate way of thinking about things. Yes, there are parents in this family unit, which is a pack, but when we first started observing wolf behavior, we observed a lot of aggression between packs, and we thought that was how they related to each other. And what we realize now is that, in fact, it's a lot more deferential, a lot more kind of calmer relationships within that pack. So the pack is really a family unit comprised of parents and several generations, usually, of their female offspring. So that year's puppies are male and female, but usually at about between 1 to 2 years of age, the males start to range away. And so the males disperse and the females stay for many years, sometimes till they're 3 or 4. And then when they're sort of sexually mature, then they range off and find one of those roving males and create a new family unit. So as such, a pack of wolves really needs about 400 square miles. Now that's not incredible if you do the math. That's, a 20 mile by 20 mile type area. However, it is a big enough area that a lot of protected spaces can't house that. For example, where I am from, Colorado State University is nearest to Rocky Mountain National Park. The entire park is only 440 square miles. And if anybody's been there, it's up and then down. So not most usable space, for example. So that kind of comes into play as the story comes back around to trying to reintroduce them. But we're going to start with a quote from Aldo Leopold, who was an ecologist that was not only a beautiful speaker and writer, but kind of a thinker of the time. So he wrote, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch, and I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean a hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." He is someone who was shaped by this struggle of extirpation of predators, and then what is the role, what are the consequences of our actions as humans now that we've removed them? What do we stand to learn from this? So he was kind of the first voice that began speaking about a field that before that was really unheard of, called ecology, which is really the study of how things intermesh and how plants and animals and birds and insects all rely on each other, and that as we disturb one, we disturb all. So what has been the role of wolves? Why do we need wolves? We all live somewhere, probably, that we have a lot of deer or large ungulates, deer, elk, moose. And we tend to have a lot of them because the biggest predators are not as popular or populous as they were at one point. So that means that their population numbers have swelled. And at least where I live, and along the East Coast where I visited, the deer and the elk are so numerous that they tend to eat themselves out of house and home. So a lot of the time they're eating into suburban areas, they're eating a large number of things that aren't meant for them, and sometimes they starve to death because there's simply not enough food for them, especially in a place with hard winters. So what we learn is that wolves have a role as a predator in keeping populations down in number so that they don't starve. Now, I bet you guys back there who I talked to in Narnia before, I bet you guys know what kinds of animals those wolves might eat. Would they eat the healthiest ones, or do you think they might eat the ones that might be a little sick or slow? What do you guys think?
I think they would eat the ones that are sick and slow.
I think you're right. And so,
sick and slow.
We have a couple votes for that. Awesome. So I think they're absolutely right, because we think of predators in some ways, kind of still with this historic picture painted for us, that they're somehow bad, they're somehow mean, they somehow kill wantonly and don't use what they kill. But being a predator is hard. It's not easy, and it's not guaranteed. So your meal is not a guaranteed option. So you're not going to go after the strongest, fastest male in the group. You're going to go after somebody slower. Or like one day on the tundra, I was watching a group of coyotes trail after an elk with a painfully, obviously broken leg. Like when it walked, its leg would flip. I mean, it was seriously not good. And I thought, oh, and I started to think, oh my gosh, that poor elk, because it's going to kind of languish for a while, knowing that a big animal like that really can't function on three legs. And lo and behold, five coyotes came out trailing behind it. They had a chance at that elk. They were small, but they had a chance at that elk simply because of its extreme injury. So we need wolves in our ecosystems to help keep them functioning. So the big bad wolf. This is the question that we're going to answer by looking at history. How did this big bad wolf image become established? Why was it important for us to fear wolves? There hasn't been a wild wolf that was healthy, that attacked a person. There have been examples of sick wolves that may have had interactions with people, but it wasn't as though wolves killed people. They didn't. It wasn't as though they really interfered with anything but our interests as far as economics and possibly livelihood. So does anybody know when we started to see a start in our history as the United States, when we started to see a change in how we treated them? When did we start trying to kill them off? Does anybody know? Yes, ma'am.
Because we, well, when we started competing with them for food, or...
What kind of food have you heard was the food that we were competing with them for?
Buffalo or elk.
Okay.
Sheep.
Cattle.
Cattle and sheep. And the unfortunate thing is that the way it all happened, it started because, you know, we did some things first and then they had nothing left to do but our own domestic livestock. It started with us coming west. Prior to 1840, most of everybody was on the east of the Missouri River. Not as many people came across. We began to see the possibilities in 1804 with Lewis and Clark. We began to see what there was out here, that there was land, it could be fertile, and that it was mostly what we regarded as empty. That there were no people there to compete with. We didn't really view Native Americans as competition. We sort of viewed only other types of settlers as competition. And so, in 1842, the Oregon Trail was established that spanned the country, and it was a great undertaking to go out west. It was not a casual thing. Most people who left were not going to see family again. They had limited, if any, hope of sending mail back. It was as though they were going to the moon in many ways. So it was a big, great adventure. Then, a few years after that, we had another reason to come out west, not just to establish a place to farm, but maybe to get rich. And this appealed to a lot of immigrants, because a lot of immigrants came to America because they were the second, third, and fourth, and fifth children. They didn't have any hope of inheriting anything. They didn't have anything that was a familial land for them, and they wanted to be able to have a stake in the world. And so the gold rush appealed to them. It was short-lived, but it got a lot of people out west to California. And as such, a lot of people stopped off along the way and never made it to California because they found a good place to be. Then in 1862, this really did appeal to settlers. The Homestead Act was created, which basically was a really neat opportunity for people to get a homestead of their own. Because if they went out west, they were given 40 acres. If they farmed that 40 acres, and I think they had to plant trees on 5 of them. They had to plant trees on 5 of them and farm the rest, they would get given that land. So as long as they made it a workable thing for several years, then they got that land entitled to them. After that started, we saw the Transcontinental Railroad become completed. It was being worked on throughout. But the railroad allowed people who were kind of the chickens up here to come out, you know, in a more fashionable way 20 years later, where they might have hope of seeing people again. They might come out west and then go back for the winter. Some people did that. And then, shortly after that, because of the railroad a lot and moving things around, we could see cattle and sheep and livestock develop. So ranching, the era of ranching began. And, you know, it didn't take a long time. And if you look at this, this was one person's lifetime. We saw, oh my gosh, there's a wonderful wealth out west to, okay, now let's get on the train and go out and live there. Unfortunately, that created a lot of changes for the animals that lived here. So... once the railroad especially was started, this is a picture, a historical representation of hunting bison from the train. Because the train went across the Great Plains and the bison roamed there in the herds that were millions. And we became, in the 1870s, kind of sport hunters. Because all these folks that came out from east of the Missouri, and prior to that, within their lifetime usually, from Europe, those places, like especially Europe, had been hunted for hundreds of years. There weren't abundant animals there. And if they were private property. And so a lot of the time, you know, nobody had seen the wealth of animals that we had out here in the West. And at that time, humans were fairly egocentric. Maybe not everything has changed. But we still felt like at that point, we felt like we couldn't do anything to this wealth, this immense mass of animals. We couldn't possibly affect it. Our actions didn't matter. So people would hunt more than they needed. They would hunt for sport. And I read one account from hunting from the train where they would have competitions to see how many they could get in a day. How many could they get in an hour? They never went out to clean those carcasses. They never went out to use any part of that animal. And prior to this era, the bison especially had been an incredibly important part of the Native Americans' lifestyle. They used everything. When they killed a bison, you know, they gave thanks for the opportunity to have all of that meat, the hide, the bone, where they made tools from it. I mean, they made glue from various parts of it. They used everything. And they kind of were not wasteful. And so seeing us come out and waste their most precious resource also bred tension, which is a whole other story. But what we found was that by 1900, our impact had left a big mark. We had taken the numbers from 80 million to 800 in about 30 years. And it's incredible when you think about that, because it's just a matter of not understanding how we need to relate to things, how we need to conserve things. And that was for our first stab at it. And we didn't do very well. Other large prey animals followed. The hunting for sport, the excess hunting, hunting more than you needed, applied to all. It was not only bison. Bison were the most targeted by the train, simply because it was easy. But all of the large animals were targeted. And so basically, we kind of were naive. We had never seen so many. We thought we couldn't harm. We thought we wouldn't make a difference. And before we knew it, within 30 years, we'd made a tremendous difference. So this was the largest decline in animals in our history was these 30 years. So setting up the scene, by 1900, most of the prey that wolves ate were becoming exceedingly scarce. And I really believe that it, had this not been a fundamental part of our story, then we may never have had such a conflict with these predators. Had we not cleaned out the cupboards before we really started realizing what the problem was, we might not have ever had as big of a conflict. But it happened. And then, oh, here's a couple historical pictures kind of to compare. This would be a painting kind of representing the hills dark with buffalo. It was not uncommon to see, you know, a herd size of 1 million buffalo. And this is why buffalo were considered a keystone species. Does anyone know what that means? Anybody know what a keystone species is? It is a species of animal that changes the environment around it for all of the other animals. So not every animal is a keystone species. Most of the time they live in their environment and they don't alter it. But buffalo, beaver, let's see, what's another one? Oh, prairie dogs. They alter their environment significantly for others. And what these animals did, why they're a keystone species, is they would wallow. And one buffalo laying down and rolling in the dirt, not much of a big deal. 1 million of them laying in the same area, wallowing in the dirt, creates a hollow. The rain comes, fills up the hollow, makes a lake. All of a sudden, new species of plants grow around the lake. New species of birds come to live there. It creates a whole new niche simply because they were there. And so the bison were important for other reasons, but they were also exterminated along with this process. So this is a bison herd that's in Yellowstone. Where the whole entire population within Yellowstone is 2,000.
Is it still 2,000?
It's around that. I don't think there's too much more. And it may be, it probably fluctuates somewhat, but I think that's probably where they carry. And now that the wolves are established, it may be a little bit less, but not substantially, I don't think. Do you know of another number?
No.
Okay. Because in general, it's sort of, I put that up there as an average of several years. So the conflict begins with predators. In their mind, all the food is gone. Their hunting has become a lot harder. When a predator goes hunting, it's only 1 in 10 times that they even catch dinner. Now, I brought this up yesterday, and I'll bring it up again. We know when dinner is. We know where we can go get it. we know it's not going to bite us or kill us or in other ways hurt us to eat it. And so for them, they risk injury, they risk death every time that they try and go get a meal. And it's very possible to die along the way from injuries. Getting kicked in the head by a bison probably isn't really good. So it's sort of a tragic coincidence because we just finished cleaning out their cupboard of what they would normally eat, and then we replaced it. We brought in all the cattle, which are not buffalo, but they're sort of similar. We brought in sheep, and they're nice and big, and they're there, you know, whereas the deer they might have been used to eating are not there anymore. So kind of as soon as we started cleaning out their natural supply, we brought in an artificial supply. And like any good predator or any good animal worth its salt, they adapted and said, well, I'm not going to die. I've got some options. You know, I'm going to try and go to this weird smelling, strange, new, never seen it before, but it's breathing. Must be good. So it set up a great conflict because these cattle ranchers had brought these cattle out at great expense. They were bringing them out to the West to hopefully make a buck, you know, hopefully make some money off of them. And all of a sudden their herds are being decimated. Their herds, they're experiencing a lot of loss. And so, so we listen to what our parents and our grandparents tell us. And in this conflict, as it grows on through the 1900s, into the 20th century, people's parents and grandparents did remember a time when wolves did decimate their livestock. It did happen. And this is why. So it became a problem for the government. They even set a bounty. Out of this came a new trade for people to come out west. Come out west to be a fur trapper. Get rid of our predators. We'll pay you, and you can sell the fur. So it's like you collect the bounty, and then you also get to get some money off of the fur. So there was a whole new trade that evolved around this. And being paid in 1910, $5 a head for a wolf could be a lot of money. It could be a decent living at that time. So people came out west for this new reason. And it generally was good publicity to say, well, we're trying to get rid of all these things, so everybody who sees one, make sure you shoot it. You can collect a bounty too. You can, you know, everybody who's involved can get a little bit of benefit because we need them gone. And it came to, you know, stealing children and threatening your family. And they were threatening families, just not directly. They were threatening the cattle that were hopefully feeding the family. And so it just kind of became an awful cycle. So here are some sad pictures of kind of the historical look at, you know, how many they would catch within a short time span. Some of the ways that they trap them, traps and poison. And we can't even poison any animal. We want to poison well now. Think about how much kind of collateral damage was probably involved with that then. So if we need a pest species removed, we always still make mistakes. We still don't do a great job with it. So these are
on the lower left, is that a wolf and pups?
Yes, it is. And each one counted. Each one counted. So the puppies were not exempt. Mothers with puppies were not exempt.
$50, where's the hides?
I know. You can start to see where people would go, I'm going to get good at this. I know how to do this. And just like with the buffalo, and just like with the deer, it became harder and harder to find them because there were fewer and fewer of them. So in the 1880s, later in the 1880s, it was reported that wolves were becoming rare. In 1915, the government trappers came in to take over and finishing everything. And by the 1920s, they were done. The last reported wolf was killed in South Dakota, 25. Last reported wolf killed in Montana, 27. And 120 wolves were killed in Yellowstone. And that was the end. And right around then, we started to see a change. And actually, it was in the 30s that Aldo Leopold kind of became a voice for, what have we done? What have we done now? And it wasn't only the wolves that they were hunting. They were hunting all the big predators. The wolves were kind of a particular extermination effort. But any big predator, especially a big predator that could, in fact, threaten a man, like a bear or a mountain lion, those were consistently shot on sight.
at beaver 5. Trapping was also in there.
Beaver trapping was due to the fashion in Europe. That was a lot of the fashion in Europe that prompted the beaver trapping. And beavers are another keystone species, interestingly enough, because they dam the water and slow it down. So Aldo Leopold began studying the role of predators. Now absent, it provides an interesting scientific experiment. You remove something from an ecosystem, what does the ecosystem do? We knew how it was before, how is it now? And by the 1940s, we were seeing a dramatic increase in deer, elk, and moose populations. We also saw starvation, increases in diseases, and population crashes, where once the whole population is out of food, almost all of them die. So instead of having a normal natural die-off when just the weaker ones that can't find the food or aren't as quick die off, everybody died off because once the food was gone for them, it was gone. And usually it's winter that ends up being a culminating point. And where I am from, the elk populations live in that overpopulated state right now. And in the winter, it is not uncommon to find dead elk because they simply can't satisfy their metabolic needs with the food that's available. So basically what he learned was what these young gentlemen already knew, is that prey populations are healthier with predators. I really like this quote, and I still think humans as a species are struggling with this. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see it, land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. And this is something that's a really interesting idea. The idea that everything doesn't belong to us, that we can't control everything, in such a way that it suits our immediate short-term purpose. Almost always, as we go through history and we've made some giant, colossal effort to remove something from the earth, almost always there's unseen things that follow that we just weren't seeing far enough ahead. We weren't thinking as many steps ahead like in a chess game you have to. You can make the short-term move and think you're doing well, and then in the long run, it doesn't work out. And I think that this is something that I think that from all levels, I'm sure you're hearing a lot of things about politics and faith and religion. I think from all levels, this is something we can struggle with as a question. How can we do better as the stewards of our earth? And the idea of being a steward is caring for something that isn't ours, but caring for it with the idea that we're preserving it for the future. So we kind of struggled through the 40s and the 50s, and then it became something that more and more people started to become educated about and become aware of, which was the idea of ecology, the interrelationships between species, between plants and animals, etc. So in 1964, the Wilderness Act was enacted, and what it did was it preserved large expanses of roadless area. We are right next to one of the wilderness areas that was created in 1964. The Glacier Peak Wilderness Area is just a little bit that way. If you walk a mile and a quarter or so, you'll hit a big log that has a little cut through it, which basically says now you're entering wilderness. And wilderness was meant to be preserved as though it were in the late 1800s. It is not supposed to have mechanized vehicles. It is not supposed to have mechanized tools, which means that anybody who does trail maintenance there does it by hand. If they chop down a tree, they're going to chop it with an axe. They're not going to chop it with a chainsaw. There are laws that go with that, including preservation of the sound. So that means you can't fly over at certain elevations. You can't do helicopter tours because that disrupts the wilderness for those that are using it. And frequently, there are carrying capacities associated with it. Here we don't have to worry. This wilderness area is one of the most remote ones in Washington, so not a lot of people come here to visit. We are pretty much the visitors to this wilderness area. And luckily, Colon Village culture helps us be prepared for going to that wilderness area. We leave no trace. We pack out our trash. We try not to leave evidence that we were there, so that we leave it the same for the next person who comes along. other wilderness areas that are more near populous areas will have a sign-in, sign-out sort of policy of this is the number that can be coming in today. These are the number of camping, you know, the camping that we can support. But the idea started with roadless areas. Let's preserve the roadless areas before they get roads in them, before we build roads every single place we can think of. And there are a few areas, few wilderness areas that are kind of grandfathered in. But if you want to think about levels of protection, we have, you know, sort of the state park system, we have the BLM lands like national forests. Those are meant to be for recreation areas for people. They do try and protect wildlife and protect plants and trees, but they do it in a way that still lets us use the area. Whether it's using it to cut firewood, using it to cut a Christmas tree, we can still use the area. Then we get to the National Park Service. They tend to try and preserve the area for itself. They do allow use, but it's not the same type of use. For example, you can take your dog hiking in a national forest. You can't take them hiking in a national park. They're not allowed to be off trail because then that's another animal conflicting with the resident wildlife. And then the wilderness area would be on top of that. That is even the most strict guidelines for use. So it is really there to be preserved for future generations. Because we don't know what our country is going to look like in 100 years. These wilderness areas, while we can enjoy a lot of similar things now, it's entirely possible that this may be incredibly important. In 1973, they began, they enacted the Endangered Species Act, which began to protect particular species. We exterminated a lot more than just a few species at the beginning of our century in the 1900s. And so we listed by species and by state which animals needed to still be preserved, which populations still needed to be preserved. And the wolves were listed as endangered. After they were listed, that gave them a level of protection, meaning there were stiffer punishments if you were to shoot one. If you were to try and go out and hunt a wolf, it was not publicly popular. Privately, I think people probably still did, but populations began to improve where there were wolf populations. So they climbed, in Minnesota, it climbed to 1,750 by the late 90s. And at that point, Minnesota delisted it on a state level because they felt they had a big population. Now, there's some debate as to whether once things were listed as endangered, they were delisted too quickly. And I think that we're starting to see some of that in the Montana, Wyoming, Idaho area. However, I'm getting ahead of myself because we really haven't gotten them back there yet. At that point in the late 90s, or at that point, sorry, in the 80s, they started to see wolves being present in those areas, sightings of wolves. Just lone wolves here and there, but evidence that they were kind of starting to come down from Canada, come in from neighboring areas, and use that as possibly the beginning of reestablishing. And the kind of interesting part to why they went ahead with reintroduction is that if it was reintroduction, then it's an experimental population. And an experimental population can be removed at any time if it's not successful. If they had allowed them to recolonize that area, they would have been protected under the Endangered Species Act. So they still are. However, it's just a different level of protection. So they began in the 1980s to put together a plan. Where was the best place to put wolves? So that they could come into the ecosystem and be viewed by the public. And it was decided that Yellowstone, which is a tremendously large park, I think it's something like 40,000 square miles. That'd be right. No, 4,000 square miles, I think.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Sure.
Yeah, 4,000 square miles. Sorry, I'm not looking. They had a lot of prey base that was appropriate. So they had a lot of the things that wolves historically ate, because wolves were there only, you know, 60 years before. And so it was a good place for them to kind of consider bringing in wolves that would be viewed by the public, because there are roads through the heart of Yellowstone. People can now go and see wolves, and it's really exciting. So when they polled the public at that time in the 80s, they weren't sure what the public would think about reintroducing wolves, so they wanted to see what was the public's reaction. overwhelmingly, people wanted wolves back. People wanted to be able to go somewhere to see a wolf. And what happened was the area ranchers who remembered that time back at the turn of the century were very against that. They did not want to have their livestock become affected again. They didn't want to lose their livelihood that they'd worked so hard for. And this is where, you know, the things that our parents tell us and the things that our grandparents tell us, we internalize and we believe in, regardless of whether the data may have changed. And so if you think about different things in your life that you got told that you found out later were not true, you know, that just were their belief and they told you as though it were fact, and it's kind of the same thing. We feel like the things that our parents and our grandparents tell us are always true. And in this case, it was true, but with some caveats. However, there was a lot of concern and a lot of hard feelings about reintroducing wolves to those areas. As part of that, there was a private interest group that said, well, if that's the concern, then we'll raise money and privately to reimburse you for any losses you have. So you won't be out any money. You won't be out any economic loss. And so this group came into being, and within the first week, they had over $1 million in donations that were going to reimburse ranchers if they had any problems. And it became a very successful thing. 1995, wolves were finally reintroduced to the area. But, So this was the cover of a magazine, and the title called The Return of the Wolf. And I'm going to tell you exactly how they did it. You'd think with as many years of planning it as they had, it would have gone more smoothly the first time. But it didn't. They went up to Canada, and they picked out, they did think it through, they tried to think it through, but nobody had really attempted this sort of a large mammal transplant before. So they went up to Canada, and they found areas that were ecologically very similar to Yellowstone, had similar prey, similar season, and that would have felt somewhat familiar to these wolves. And they kind of trapped them from the air. They darted them from the air, individual wolves that were not related to each other. And they put them in a little box, and they flew them down. And in the beginning, they did what was called hard release, which was they let them out of the box in Yellowstone and let them go. And what happened with that was they let them go, and they have them radio collared, so they at least did that, and they watched the radio collars go straight back up to Canada. It took some of them as few as 5 days to get there. So they pretty much were like, I know where I'm supposed to be. This is not it. I don't know any of those ones over there. I'm going back. And so the hard release, they were like, okay, that didn't work out so well. And if they thought about it for a second, although at that point they were still kind of operating on some different assumptions about wolves as far as how they form relationships, pretty much what happened was they took a lot of strangers and gave them no reason to hang out with each other at all, no experience with each other at all, and put them in a foreign place. So they went to what they knew. That was called a hard release. What they did next was a soft release. So what they did next was they did the same sort of trapping and the same sort of reacquiring, but they brought them down and they built an enclosure. They built an enclosure that was many, many acres so that they could get to know each other in a controlled space. And they couldn't run back to Canada. And they kept them there for a number of months, in fact, through the winter. And what they found by spring was they actually had pups from that group that had become very socially bonded with each other. These are some of the pictures of some of the wolves that were starting to try and learn where they fit in with each other. It's not usual for adult wolves that don't know each other to form a group, other than a mated pair with their offspring. So with these all adult wolves, they actually had a number of puppies born in 1995. They had a number more puppies. They brought down more wolves in 1996 that winter. They had more puppies born by that spring. And so in 1997, they decided not to bring down another transplant group from Canada because they had already achieved the numbers they were looking for based on what they brought down and the puppies that were born. So they added 7 orphan wolves from various sources, and then 64 puppies were born that year. So it was tremendously successful once they gave them the chance to form bonds and social relationships. So what were the expected results of the introduction, or the reintroduction of the wolf? What were they expecting to happen to everything else? They were expecting to see about 10 to 15% of decrease in deer, elk, and bison populations. They weren't expecting the wolves to compete adversely or in a bad way with the cougars or the grizzlies that were there. They were expecting to see a decrease in coyotes. And this was sort of a sad thing, because prior to the wolf reintroduction, some of the most well-studied populations of coyotes and some of the most protected populations of coyotes were in Yellowstone. And it was there that we learned that if we don't hunt coyotes, they also form social groups. They also form packs. But if they're fragmented, living in sort of suburban and urban type fringe areas, where their population is constantly randomly controlled by people, they tend to be single, or they tend to have, you know, sort of fragmented groups. So we did see a decrease in those populations because wolves view them as direct competitors. So when they are looking for a territory and they want territory X and coyotes are living there, they kill them so they can have that territory. And they win because the coyotes are about half their size. So there's not really an option. As a bonus, because red foxes compete with coyotes but not with wolves, we were expecting to see an increase in their populations, which did in fact happen. And they were expecting, based on the prey that was available to them and what they were used to doing in Canada, that there would not be a measurable effect on domestic livestock. So what actually happened? Well, what happened was that wolves did get reclassified from endangered to threatened in 2003. They did get removed from the list in 2009, which is felt by many to be a little too early. The ecological impacts, they were in fact correct about the coyotes. So the populations of coyotes that were well studied over time did get kind of decreased and in some cases removed from the areas they were in. They saw that they were expecting about 12 elk per wolf per year, and they in fact saw that they preferred elk over many other things, and they ate 22 elk per wolf per year on average. So the elk populations, which really did need controlling, were getting controlled to a little bit more of a degree. This is an actual picture from Yellowstone, wolves chasing an elk. And it's nice to chase those animals in deep snow, because wolves can move better in deep snow than the elk can. So it gives them an advantage in winter if they can chase them into deep snow. So what about the livestock? The livestock, what happened each year was I never know which order to put these in. Let's look at the wolf numbers first, so you have an idea of what the wolf numbers were. So as we increase the number of wolves each year, you see we kind of get to roughly a stable carrying capacity. We see some decreases in some years because there were some outbreaks of parvo and some diseases that domestic dogs kind of shared with the wolf. But overall, we see an increase in wolf populations each year consistently, pretty much to 2004, which is where our numbers were. So now, going back, you can see that when we look at the number of disturbances for cattle, sheep, and domestic dogs, that while our wolf populations grew each year, for the most part, they didn't necessarily change what the livestock numbers were. Some years there were a few, some years there were a few more, but overall, it wasn't that many. And those ranchers were reimbursed for that. The dogs are viewed as a competitor, much like the coyote. So if a dog and a wolf were to have an altercation, that might not turn out well. If we look at kind of overall numbers of cattle per wolf and sheep per wolf, we kind of look at Not very many. So we're thinking about 24 elk per year and 0.04 or 0.2 sheep per year. And over time in Idaho, you actually see a decrease in the numbers. So they were pretty much right in that they didn't have an appreciative effect on the livestock. Not certainly like they had in the 20s and before, where it really was proportional, big percentages. This is kind of a schematic. This just kind of shows you where Yellowstone is in relationship to the states, so Wyoming, Idaho, Montana. And Yellowstone kind of occupies that upper corner of Wyoming, so the range can go outside the park. And over here, it's kind of showing you where the different packs had their territories. Where did they use denning sites, and what were they doing in those different areas? So you can see that, you know, the color coding, you know, they use different denning sites, but they're using roughly the same territory, and they're not generally overlapping as much. So they had a number of different packs, and these are some of the best studied wolves around. Because they radio collared them, they had them visually identified with markings, so they knew who they were looking at when they saw things happen to them. And over the years, some things did happen. They got hit by cars, or occasionally they got poached, even in the park. So they found a radio collar, you know, and a carcass, you know, with a bullet, you know, and it's not something that happened very often, but it did happen. So here's kind of looks at the number of packs. So you can sort of see the number of packs stayed relatively stable. For the adults, they had their pups each year. Some of the pups naturally, you know, they've listed the number surviving. Pup mortality is something that happens in nature. So some of them don't always survive. Sometimes hawks and eagles will take the pup. Sometimes the pup will make a bad choice and fall in the water, or someplace that it can't get out of. And especially in Yellowstone, the water's not always cold. So there's accidents that happen. In fact, I remember when I was there when I was 7, seeing the carcass of a bison that had gotten surprised by Old Faithful and covered in water, like covered in boiling water accidentally. So that was kind of a terminal bad choice for that guy. So what can we do in the future? What can we do for the future? As I said, it has sort of a happy ending in that we have reintroduced wolves. We now can go someplace particular to see wolves if we want to, and they're sighted regularly. They're not just back off in the hinterlands, not seen by anyone. They are sighted regularly. We need to alter what we think about when we try to interact with predators. Too often, we think we want to help them, you know, trying to feed them hot dogs or trying to feed them something. And that has gone awry for a number of reasons. It goes awry from the initial contact sometimes, like a little boy trying to feed part of a roast beef sandwich to a coyote got bitten because he didn't take it like his dog at home took it from his hand. But that was a sad consequence too, because then they had to kill the coyote because he'd bitten a person. So, yeah, Sharon.
I was wondering what you think about the people who make them pets.
Oh, the wolf hybrids. Wow. Interesting topic. I think that tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about domestication, and I think domestication does a lot with behavior, that when you have a wolf hybrid or a wolf, you're really having a tame animal with a lot of intact drives and a lot of intact fear. And so when you see, by drives, I mean intact prey drive, so that they have no, you know, poems about digging through the couch to find the little squeaky at the bottom, because that's what they should do. But I think that you have kind of a wild animal a little bit in the house, and I think that it's a little bit challenging for most owners.
So it's pretty much, it implies just like exotic animals, people that try to make them pets. It's,
I think with I mean, the wolf hybrid question is a little bit challenging, because I think that you can have a dog that looks exactly like a wolf and have it be a husky or a malamute and have it be temperamentally wonderfully stable. I think you can have an honest to gosh, you know, wolf hybrid and have a very challenging animal who has a lot of you know, fear and potential for aggression simply because they are wild. Mm-hmm. And they may at best be tamed, and we'll talk more about that. So with regard to wolves, and their plight in the wilds, because certainly while there's a lot of overlap with people who think their dogs are too wild to live at home and want to release them, these are actual wild, you know, populations. I think that we have a problem in that we have brought them in, we've successfully introduced them, they are doing well, and we've removed them from protection. And there's still a lot of education that needs to happen for everyone in the public as to what that means. I think somebody said that shoot, shovel, and shut up about it is a kind of way that a lot of people, ranchers and such, handle wolves on their property still. And I think that we may see a decline in numbers, you know, because of that that very very emotional population that still feels like eradication is the best choice. They do have a hunting season for them now, which is distressing to me. In I think Montana or Idaho, but there are, you know, there are other states where there are a few isolated populations that are beginning, like here in Washington. I believe there's four different packs that have been established to greater or lesser degree. They enjoy different types of protection depending on where they are, and I think it's a challenge to live with wildlife of all types. I think it's a challenge to be. Like, for example, we get to come and enjoy Holden, and Holden has a lot of rules so that they can live well with their environment. They are completely, you know, well, not maybe completely, but pretty close to being self-sustainable. They do great things with keeping food away so that wildlife doesn't come into the village and try and raid the garbage. I think there's a lot that most environments, most communities could learn about how to live with wildlife successfully by simply not tempting them into making bad choices and not tempting that conflict. But what I hope you've come away with, at least an understanding of where we came from and how we got here and how our relationship with predators has started. And for me, seeing a predator is a special treat. So when I get to see a fox or a pine marten or a coyote or a wolf, to me it's a little bit of magic because I know how rare it is to see them doing what they do. And it's a little bit of nostalgia for how it could have been. You know, how could we have done things differently, maybe, and not ended up with the contentious relationship that we have with them somewhat now. And everybody makes a difference. Every single person and every action that you have makes a difference. And whether it's how you vote, whether it's how you influence a neighbor, whether it's how you try and educate a child, I think that we all have a capacity for helping make good positive change for the future. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Could you mention something about maybe the environment or the ecology of Yellowstone after the introduction of the wolf?
You mean like prey populations and such?
Not only prey, but the plant populations.
Oh, the plant populations.
The rivers.
Yeah, actually, and I usually bring that up because when big prey animals like elk and deer get overpopulated, some of the things that they do in the winter are especially harmful to like migratory bird populations. And you go, how can the wolf affect migratory birds? Well, this is how. So when there are too many big animals trying to graze on brush and bushes and, like, for example, willows next to rivers and things like that, in the wintertime, when there are too many of them, they eat the bushes down to where they can't grow again, or they don't have the right foliage to attract those migratory birds. We have some beautiful migratory birds here in the village right now, one of which I know is an affected species by this, which is the western tanager. They live in the populations of brush next to riparian areas. And so when there are too many elk and too many deer, those get decimated. And they actually, in Rocky Mountain National Park, had to, because we don't have wolves, we don't have an adequate control of elk, we fenced them. They fenced the riparian areas to allow those areas to recover because worldwide those bird species were suffering. So it's just another sort of ripple that we drop it in the bucket and don't think about all the ripples that rush out to touch everyone else. I don't know if that's what you were thinking about, but I'm sorry, I usually mention that. Thank you guys for your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions. Yes, sir.
We live at a retirement center, Mary Woods, just outside of Portland.
Yeah.
and along the shore of the Willamette River, and we have coyotes there.
That's exciting. I'm always excited to hear that coyotes can live in and around populated areas. They are one of the most adaptable canine species. They certainly are even more adaptable than the wolf, I think, because of their range of possible things that they eat. But they have been, they are kind of all along, everywhere from Canada on down through Mexico and across most of the ecosystems in the United States. Most, not all, but almost all. Yeah.
This image of the big bad wolf, how much has been affected by the stories coming out of Eastern Europe, the folk stories now Siberian?
You know, I think there's probably some good rooting of that there. I think that, you know, and maybe for much the same reason. I'm not as familiar with the historical influences of wolves there. I think it's always been a good reason to keep your children close, to scare your children into doing what you want them to do. You know, stay close to me on the hike or the cougar's going to eat you. Okay. You know, so, you know, when you tell children that, which we do need to tell them about cougars, you know, but when we tell children that, they remember that, you know, and that's something else that you kind of keep as extra value. Well, I know that they could eat me. I know that they could eat me. You know, so I think it's a good way to keep everybody in line, too. Yes, sir.
We also have deer in that area.
Great.
Frequently we will see deer wandering around.
That must be a beautiful place to live. Beautiful place. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.